Nearly all of Montazeri's works before 1979 were on arcane treatment of such aspects of Shi'i jurisprudence as religious alms, religious taxes, religious punishments, and unlawful gains. He uncritically complied lectures of his teachers Ayatollah Barujerdi and Ayatollah Khomeini on roots of jurisprudence, Usul al-Fiqh, as well as on the Friday prayers and on travellers' devotional obligations. He also published an anti-Baha'i polemic indicative of his strong anti-Baha'i sentiments. None of these works, published or unpublished, dwelled in the realm of politics. Before the revolution, his political activism was more on the pulpit than in writing. It was only in the years leading to the Islamic Revolution that he and like-minded jurists of his generation fully engaged in the discourse of political Islam. His lectures on legal foundations of the doctrine of the guardianship of the jurist, which was rendered in Arabic and later translated into Persian, was one of several works articulated immediately after the revolution with clear political connotations. His extensive commentary on Najj al-Balagha, a series of lectures on the sermons attributed to Ali, the first imam, was another. They indicated a shift from earlier studies of jurisprudence and his preoccupation with ritualistic aspects of Shi'i Islam. As one of the framers of the 1979 constitution, and as the designated successor to Imam Khomeini, Montazeri played an important part in the early consolidation of the Islamic Republic. Only isolation in the years following his fallout with Khomeini in 1988 to 1989, and the experience of harassment by hardliners, brought Montazeri to a more tolerant legal and moral perspective, atypical of Gomes' clerical activists of his time. Of the same generation as Montazeri, and equally instrumental in the early consolidation of the Islamic regime, was Mahmoud Taleghani. He was a cleric of radical convictions, but with a wider horizon than his cohorts. His atypical interest in writing a Quranic commentary with a politico-moral message was reminiscent of Sayyid Qutb. Born to a family of village mullahs in the Taleghan region in northwestern Iran, Taleghani, too, was a product of Faizieh. A one-time supporter of the Fadayan-e-Islam, in 1953 he harboured their leader, Nawab-e-Safavi, and later, in 1965, helped fund the assassination of the Premier Hassan Ali Mansour. As a vocal member of Mahdi Bazargan's freedom movement, he was detained, convicted by a military court, and spent long years in jail. More as a collaborator than a follower of Khomeini, he was sympathetic to the Mujahideen-e-Khalq, with whom he spent time in prison. His relatively independent stance in the post-revolutionary days briefly made him a champion of the moderate Islamists and a fatherly figure for the Mujahideen-e-Khalq. Taleghani's study of the concept of property in Islam displayed his faint socialist sympathies, an aspect that set him apart from mainstream Gom authorities. After the victory of the revolution, his pluralist approach and greater tolerance for other readings of Islam and secular ideologies were increasingly at odds with Khomeini's exclusivist brand. His death from a heart attack in September 1979, in the heat of the post-revolutionary struggle, was the first of several losses that deprived the Islamic Republic of its relatively moderate and broader-minded leaders. If he had survived, he could have potentially served as a counterweight to Khomeini's radicalizing agenda, even though in his first public face-off with the leader of the revolution, when he criticized the arrest of some sympathizers of the Mujahideen-e-Khalq, he quickly yielded to Khomeini's reverse decision. Of the second tier of students loyal to Khomeini were Akbar Hashimi Rafsanjani and Sayyid Ali Khamenei. Their numbers exceeded no more than perhaps a half dozen, but they constituted a core for wider support within and beyond the clerical establishment. Rafsanjani, who was born to a family of landowning pistachio growers in Bahreman, a small village 45 miles north of Rafsanjan in Kerman province, had never travelled beyond the vicinity of his village until he was 14 years old, when in the fall of 1948 he first travelled to Gom to receive clerical training. Listening to radio was not conventional. Before leaving my village, I had not seen a receiver, recalled Rafsanjani. This was my first trip outside my village. Before then, I only once had travelled about one farsakh, 4 miles, outside. From the village to the main road, we ride on a donkey. There were no cars in our village. I guess we waited, in another village close to the main road, for 3 days for a truck to appear. We sat atop the cargo. In Gom, young Rafsanjani gravitated toward anti-regime dissent and became one of the founders of the journal Maktab-e-Tashayu, the school of Shi'ism, one of the two major journals in Gom that, since 1959, debated modern themes from an Islamic perspective with the hope of engaging a wider, religiously inclined readership outside Gom. In contrast to the better-known Maktab-e-Islam, which since 1958 had appeared as the organ of the Gom Hoze and enjoyed the patronage of Borujerdi and later Ayatollah Shariat Madari, the Maktab-e-Tashayu's approach was proactive and mildly critical of the regime. When Rafsanjani and his colleagues appealed to Khomeini for his patronage, he declined, no doubt to the great disappointment of the contributors, many of them later among supporters of Khomeini and active in the revolution. Decades later, Rafsanjani went to a great length to justify Khomeini's inaction. All in all, we had a well-rounded impression of the Imam, Khomeini. We could not spot any weakness or fault in him. Even if there were some issues, which were contrary to our expectation, such as his reclusive predisposition, reluctance to appear on the stage and take a stance in such political currents as the oil nationalization movement, and support for Fadayan-e-Islam, later it became clear that he was right. If he acted in accordance with our wishes, perhaps it would have left some ill impression on others. Besides, at the time of Ayatollah Borujerdi, honouring his wishes was a necessity. Without his consent, no movement in Gom would have fully succeeded. Like Montazeri, here Rafsanjani's portrayal of Khomeini is reverential and yet indicative of his reluctance to politically engage. Further, in their accounts, both authors attribute Khomeini's quietism to attacks that he was sustaining at the time from the ultra-conservative quarters in Gom, who objected to his interest in philosophy and mysticism, and especially in the great 13th-century Andalusian mystic Muhyiddin ibn al-Arabi. Only in the years following the death of Borujerdi and with the completion of moderate marjas in Gom and Najaf, did Khomeini begin to draw the support of such radicalized clergy as Montazeri, Rafsanjani, Matahari, and Beheshti, and emerge as the only outspoken Gom critic of the Pahlavi state. In contrast to the small town and village backgrounds of Montazeri and Rafsanjani, another student of Khomeini, Sayyid Ali Khamenei, was born in 1939 in the city of Mashhad to a middle-ranking clerical family. He received most of his clerical education there, before going to Najaf for a brief period, and then in 1958 to Gom, where he studied under Borujerdi and Khomeini. He returned to Mashhad some years later and taught there for some time. In the aftermath of the 1963 uprising, Khamenei's activism led to his brief detention in 1966 in Birjand, in central Khorasan, and later in Tehran. Not known for his scholarship, Khamenei came to be known for his translations from Arabic into Persian. Among them were a number of works by Sayyid Qutb, whose impression of Khamenei's worldview cannot be denied. He had a side interest in Persian poetry, as well as not only Muhammad Iqbal's Persian poems, but also works of some of the new wave Iranian poets. Only in the months leading to the Islamic Revolution, however, did Khamenei gain some visibility in Khomeini's inner circle as a skilled orator, capable of articulating his mentor's message. These students, in one way or another, shared the marginality of the madrasa environment. Donning clerical garb, a stigma of a sort in the age of Pahlavi secularism, set them apart from the majority. Experiences of interrogations, exile, and detention, though seldom severe for clerics, also gave them a sense of solidarity with one another. These experiences allowed them to forge ties with other political tendencies in prison and in exile, and helped sharpen their rhetorical skills in encounters with the Mujahideen, Marxists, and other shades of political dissent, while absorbing many of the themes and arguments proposed by other forces of opposition and making them their own. Khomeini's revolutionary bandwagon in the days leading to 1979 also had a network of middle and upper clerical ranks. even during his Najaf exile, Khomeini had preserved an impressive array of agents in Iranian towns and cities, another testimony to Savak's misplaced focus on the left rather than the radical clerical circles. These agents collected arms and religious dues on Khomeini's behalf and soon became conduits for spreading his words orally and in print and on cassette tapes. They often were at the forefront of the protest rallies and responsible for recruiting lay followers to the revolutionary cause. A growing number of these clerical activists served as the backbone of the revolutionary institutions that would soon take root in the Islamic Republic. Bazaar followers of the Imam. Beyond his clerical following, Khomeini relied primarily on the bazaar for moral and financial support and for manning his revolutionary ranks. In the urban economy in the 1960s and 1970s, much of the large-scale business and international trade gradually moved out of the bazaar and into the streets. The new middle classes, who generally ran big businesses, generally had little or no traditional ties to the bazaar. Deprived of much of its economic muscle, the bazaar's mostly small merchants and wholesalers all over the country survived and even occasionally thrived. The bazaar also preserved some of its traditional functions. The export of Persian carpets, textiles, and commodities, as well as wholesale trade and retail sales of domestic and imported consumer goods, small-scale workshops, and a host of intermediaries and dealers in promissory notes, still served a sector of the middle class and poorer urban populations. The bazaaris, who ran large wholesale and petty businesses in the bazaar's stores and caravanserais within a sprawling cloister of roofed space or its virtual extensions in adjacent low-income neighbourhoods, had preserved professional loyalties. They also held ties with the clerical establishment and contributed, at times generously, to their coffers. They made up the mosque congregations, funded the Muharram mourning associations, and their rank-and-file packed Muharram and Ramadan events. The neighbourhood associations, in and out of the bazaar, often named Association of Mourners of Hussein, or after other Shi'i saintly patrons, or after His Majesty the Imam of the Age, represented indigenous civic organisations. Financed and often supervised by neighbourhood elders, they organised the Muharram procession, Dasteh, and were responsible for the upkeep of the tekyeyes and mosques. They allowed men, and especially youth, to uphold a group identity and were fertile ground for Islamic activism. The novelty of the revolution and the thrill of massive marches, distribution of clandestine tracts, and street clashes with the police and the troops excited the youth, especially when invoking paradigms of sacrifice and martyrdom rooted in Iran's Shi'i culture. Disgruntled with years of Pahlavi disdain toward the bazaar, many petty merchants and retailers alike sought in the revolution a message of deliverance and social mobility. To those who were brought up in the closely knit and religiously conscious environment of the bazaar, or in poorer neighbourhoods associated with the bazaar, the Pahlavi economy had offered relative prosperity, but did not engender political loyalty to the regime in power. Ties to the mosques and to the mullahs in charge of the mosques were made through the payment of religious dues and new recruits to clerical ranks from the children of the bazaar's petty merchants. The memory of the bazaar as a political powerhouse challenging the state was still alive, even though the bazaar's ability to effectively shut down the city's economies was far smaller than before. The Coalition of Mourning Associations, Hayataye Motalifeh, crucial in mobilizing mass support, was first formed in the early 1960s in the Tehran Bazaar and adjacent neighborhoods, and later in religious centers such as Qom, Kashan, Isfahan, and Yazd. Some of the members had been active since the 1940s as supporters of Ayatollah Abul Ghassem Kashani and affiliates of Fadayane Islam, and later in the 1960s acted as the mobilizing arm of Khomeini's protest movement. In 1960, they backed Khomeini's leadership and encouraged him to produce a treatise, Resaleh, on intricate details of jurisprudence, a prerequisite for Marjaiyat leadership. As much as they were eager to turn a mystical philosopher like Khomeini into a mainstream Fabi, the leaders of the coalition were keen to sharpen his political rhetoric as well. Leaders of the coalition, among the small merchants in the Tehran Bazaar, such as Habibullah Askarola Di, 1932-2013, and Mahdi Eraqi, 1930-1979, had close ties with the Fadayan-e Islam and were convicted and incarcerated for taking part in the 1965 assassination of Hassan Ali Mansour. In the 1963 uprising, as in 1979, they helped organize rallies, they produced placards, posters, and tracts, and they disseminated Khomeini's cassette messages. During Khomeini's exile, Askarola Di also served as Khomeini's agent, collecting religious dues from his followers. The bizarre survival as a cloister of religio-political loyalties buttressed the morale of Khomeini and his lieutenants and topped up their coffers throughout the revolt. The undoing of moderate Islamists. Khomeini's message was alluring to an assortment of lay Islamists who served him in the early days of the revolution, but were mostly disillusioned shortly afterward. They felt they had been used by Khomeini and abused by his clerical clique. To Khomeini and his turbaned cohorts, these tie-wearing advocates of the revolution were ultimately outsiders and therefore more readily disposable, even though they had paved the way for him, idealized him as a national liberator, and worked hard to make him acceptable to the middle classes as the spiritual father of the revolution. Mahdi Bazargan, the prime minister of the provisional government appointed by Khomeini in February 1979, and his colleagues in the freedom movement, were prime examples of this brand of Islamic modernism embellished with rationalized religiosity and a positivist outlook. The freedom movement was a league independent of Khomeini's cohorts that had loomed on the horizon for some time. Bazargan, a longtime advocate of a new reading of Islam and a supporter of constitutional democracy with an Islamic colouring, was born in 1908 in Tehran to a bizarre merchant family with firm religious ties. He was among the first group of Iranian students who, in 1927, under Reza Shah, received a scholarship to pursue his higher education in France. He completed his studies in thermodynamics in Paris in 1934, before joining the School of Engineering of the newly established Tehran University. Despite his impressive academic and administrative record, Bazargan was first detained for his close collaboration with Mossadegh after the 1953 coup, and again in the aftermath of the 1963 uprising, when he sustained 5 years' imprisonment and internal exile, together with other members of the Freedom Movement. Besides the Freedom Movement, he was also pivotal in founding the Islamic Association, Anjuman-e Islami, at Tehran University, as well as several Islamic associations for teachers, engineers, and physicians. Bazargan's scientific reading of Islamic doctrines and practices may well be attributed to his exposure to the revival of neo-Catholicism in France in the interwar period. What may appear to a secular mind as an outlandish take on Islamic faith were to Bazargan and his school of thought scientific evidence of Islam's veracity, its endurance, and its applicability to the needs of modern societies. His articulation of the existence of God, based on the laws of quantum physics, and his advocacy of the aerobic benefits of setting the daily prayers 5 times were just 2 examples. As early as 1936, he published the earliest version of his namaz, prayer, on scientific functions of daily prayer in Islam that went through numerous editions. Rationalizations such as these went a long way toward assuring like-minded people of the infallibility of Islam as a comprehensive system of beliefs and practice. A prolific writer, beyond publications in his own field, Bazargan published more than 230 books and pamphlets of varying size and quality on diverse religious, social, and political topics from an Islamic perspective, including Religion in Europe in 1942, Conversion Ratio between Materialism and Spirituality in 1943, Islam and Pragmatism in 1949, Love and Worship or Human Thermodynamics in 1953, A Guide to the Study of the Quran between 1959 and 1964 in 6 volumes, and Boundaries Between Religion and Politics in 1962. A veteran of the national movement of the Mossadegh era, Bazargan capitalized on his past association and his record of resistance and arrest under the Shah to make the image of a firebrand Khomeini more agreeable to ambivalent middle classes. Yet Bazargan and his colleagues were the first to go. Though respectful of Khomeini, Bazargan was a critic of the post-revolutionary excesses. Not surprisingly, his tumultuous relations with Khomeini and his cohorts led to his resignation 8 months after assuming office. Bazargan's colleague, Ibrahim Yazdi, born 1931, a member of the Freedom Movement and another early aide to Khomeini, was instrumental in promoting his cause first within the university Islamic associations in the United States. In Paris, he served as a prominent, though informal, spokesman for Khomeini, especially in dealings with the English-speaking media. He became Minister of Foreign Affairs in April 1980 after Karim Sanjabi resigned his post in protest, but he was forced to resign his post 7 months later at the outset of the hostage crisis, along with the rest of the Bazargan cabinet. He was sidelined in the turbulent years that followed, to the point of becoming an outcast, and was labelled, along with Bazargan, as a compromising liberal, liberale sazishkar. Abul Hassan Bani Sadr, born 1933, the first president of the Islamic Republic, who earlier had hosted Khomeini in Paris and served as his French-speaking facilitator, fared even less favourably. Coming from an old clerical family in Hamadan, he had earned a law degree from Tehran University and was active in the Second National Front. His Islamic orientation soon turned him into an advocate of Khomeini during and after 1963. His advocacy of a unitarian, Tawhidi economy and society was a syncretic notion rooted in the socialist reading of Islamic doctrines then in vogue among the Islamic left. With Khomeini's implicit blessing, in February 1980, he was elected as first president of the Islamic Republic, only to be ousted in disgrace 16 months later and driven out of the country into exile in France. Sadegh Ghozadeh, 1936-1982, an activist in the early days of the Confederation of Iranian Students, and reportedly at one time a student in the Georgetown School of Foreign Service, had an idealized view of political Islam that was dismissive of the conservative clergy. As a long-time advocate of Khomeini and his fashionable facade for the Western media, he gained prominence after the revolution as the head of the NRTI broadcasting services and later as Minister of Foreign Affairs, but he too soon witnessed his downfall. He was sent to the gallows in September 1982 on charges of conspiracy to stage a coup. These and a host of other lay supporters of Khomeini mostly had tinkered with their own version of Islamic discourse in the semi-secular milieu of exile in Europe and the United States. Despite serious differences among themselves, these advocates of revolution shared varying degrees of aversion toward the Ahund element, as the clergy somewhat pejoratively were known. They also were critical of the clergy's populism, rather unflatteringly in popular parlance called Ahund Bazi. Secular Iranians viewed these lay advocates of the Islamic cause as a cunning bunch who had found their place in the sun, a place that, though unstable, was the only chance to save the revolution from the mullahs. But no love was lost between them and the clerical camp, which was anxious to see their rapid downfall. The mullahs viewed the Islamic modernists as a convenient ladder for ascending to power, or as opportunists who rode to office at the back of the revolution. At stake was not merely a struggle for popular support, but warring ideological worldviews in which the radical clerics and their allies, now to be defined as Khomeinists by their critics, held the upper hand. Contrary to the mullahs, the Islamic opposition of Bazargan's brand believed in evolutionary step-by-step change. They barely upheld their inner cohesion either, which in turn made them susceptible to Khomeini's whims and wishes, and dependent on his diminishing favour. They were crucial, no doubt, in the transition period, and deemed indispensable in the early days of the Islamic Republic. They mellowed Khomeini's image, ran the provisional government, and gave the inexperienced clergy and their allies time to whet their political appetite and learn about the machinery of the state. Their sad fate clearly showed how expendable they were to Khomeini. They were outsiders, no matter how regularly they said their prayers in public, or how studiously they demonstrated Islamic loyalty to the Imam of the revolution. The downfall of the compromising liberals came about in part also because of a host of other lay Islamists loyal to Khomeini camp. Serving as technocrats and advisers to the clergy, the latter group filled the place of the lay moderates. Muhammad Ali Rajai, 1933-1981, a high school teacher and Islamic activist, was typical of the Khomeinists at odds with the revolution's moderate wing, and was rapidly propelled to power as second president of the Islamic Republic. Mir Hussein Mousavi, born 1942, who had studied interior design at the Tehran School of Design and pursued that subject further in England, became a long-serving prime minister in the early 1980s during the difficult years of the Iran-Iraq War. Mustafa Chamran, 1932-1981, a former member of Bazargan's Freedom Movement and a Berkeley-educated electrical engineer who, for some years in the 1960s, had worked in various US research institutes, was another example. Driven by the success of the Cuban Revolution and the revolutionary spirit of the period, in the early 1960s, Chamran moved to Cuba and later to Nasser's Egypt to be trained in guerrilla warfare. In 1971, at the outset of Lebanon's civil war, he moved to Beirut. By then, he had become a de facto leader of an Islamic International Brigade that helped organize dissidents in Syria and Palestine, mostly under Nasser's auspices. In Lebanon, he collaborated with the Iranian-born cleric Musa Sadra, the charismatic leader of the Shi'is of Lebanon, and was instrumental in the founding of the Shi'i Amal movement, whose radical wing later evolved into Hezbollah of Lebanon. Upon his return to Iran at the outset of the revolution, Chamran was appointed an early leader of the Revolutionary Guards and the Islamic Republic's first Minister of Defense. In 1981, in the early stages of the Iraq-Iran War, when he was leading Revolutionary Guards in the battlefield, he died from shrapnel wounds. As a martyr of the Holy Defense against the Iraqi aggressor, Chamran occupies an iconic place in the narrative of the Islamic Revolution. As a loyal soldier of the revolution appearing in military fatigues, his image in gigantic murals in Iranian cities is often interspersed with those of clerical martyrs of the revolution, presumably to highlight clergy-lay symbiosis. What differentiated Chamran and other lay activists from Bazargan and Bani Sadr were not only their willingness to comply with the emerging hierarchy under Khomeini and go along with its radical course, but also a generation gap. Whereas Bazargan and his cohorts were shaped by the national movement of the 1940s and 1950s, the younger activists mostly remembered and idealized the revolt of the 1960s led by Khomeini, and were motivated by the 1960s guerrilla warfare and radical trends in the Arab world. An Imam for the Disinherited. Beyond the circle of aides and cohorts with similar worldviews, Khomeini's appeal extended to the urban lower middle classes and the poor neighborhoods in big cities, as well as in smaller towns. The disinherited, mustazafin, of the land, at least a good portion of them, began to view him as a liberator who would improve their lot in a fast-changing society. It was these multitudes and their strength in numbers that kept him in power, despite all odds. Originally a Quranic concept, for example, Surah 28, verses 5 and 6, disinherited of the earth became a current in Khomeini's speeches and among the advocates of the Islamic Revolution. They consciously used it to supplant the favored catchphrase of the left, the deprived masses. The term has gone through a metamorphosis since it was first used by Ali Shariati to reconceptualize Frantz Fanon's Wretched of the Earth, a notion he may well have taken from the first line of the Internationale, Stand up, damned of the earth. In the early 1970s, the term quickly was sponged into the lexicon of Ayatollah Khomeini, where it found currency for years to come. The merger of the Quran and socialism via Fanon, Shariati and Khomeini became a signifier of class to be applied to the urban poor living in the slums of southern Tehran and on the fringes of Iran's rapidly growing provincial centers. It was meant to define those who were down and out among the rural immigrants and dismayed by the affluent lifestyle of the elite, the unskilled construction laborers, factory workers and small workshop apprentices, the lowly of the bazaar, menial wage earners, and the growing body of unemployed youth. The downtrodden aside, the term also included the somewhat better off but still discontent sectors of the lower middle classes, shopkeepers, public school teachers, technicians, and low-paid government employees. The men and women who were motivated through mosques and mourning associations were led to believe that Islam, and especially Shi'i Islam, packaged as an ideological miracle pill for all of Iran's ills, was not primarily a set of monotheistic beliefs, devotional acts, and moral principles, nor even loyalty to the house of the Prophet and belief in the coming of the Mahdi, but instead a religion of protest and political action against oppression and exploitation, monarchical power, and its global allies. It was among these awakened multitudes that Khomeini shrewdly managed to harness energies for his revolutionary cause. He repeatedly paid homage to what he called our valiant Islamic nation, and invariably acted on a presumed mandate on behalf of the disinherited to further the true, Rastin, objectives of his dear Islam. Inimical to the disinherited of the earth, in Khomeinist's emerging revolutionary universe and the manic rhetoric that erupted with the revolution, stood the arrogant Mustakbarin, the other end of the binary derived from another Quranic reference to the unheeded people of privilege who succumb to idolatrous tyrants, Surah 2, verse 87, the Taghut of the Quran, Surah 4, verse 51, were idol worshippers who rebelled against God and, by implication, denoted all transgressors unafraid of God's ultimate vengeance. In the language of revolutionary Iran, Taghuti thus became a code word for the Pahlavi regime and its associated elites. They were enemies of true Islam, who were about to be purged in the punitive inferno of the revolution, so as to pave the way for restoring just rule and returning to the disinherited of the earth what justly belonged to them. Not only did the revolution unseat the Taghut and its domestic cliques at home, it also promised to deter the forces of global arrogance, Estekbare Jahani, a code for global hegemony. A range of newly coined expressions brought to the surface the perception of a battle of good versus evil, a faint reflection perhaps of the old dichotomy inherent to Iranian culture. By underscoring this dichotomy, Khomeini and his supporters consciously aimed to dismantle the Marxist-inspired vocabulary of dissent, which the left perceived as an inevitable outcome of the revolution. In contrast to the left's vision of a class struggle, Khomeinists advocated a moral struggle along the path of God, a struggle that shaped history of humanity, a sacred movement driven by faith and by commitment, ta'ahud. The hope of the disinherited, of course, was Imam Khomeini, as he quickly came to be known weeks after his advent in Paris. His hybrid of Shi'i jurisprudence, precepts of Greco-Islamic philosophy, mystical outlook with a Neoplatonic flavor, and radical political viewpoint influenced by ideologies of the left and fused into an Islamic agenda, were combined to bring out in him an enduring leadership. A shrewd, almost cunning man, he enjoyed an extraordinary gift for identifying and taking advantage of opportunities. Assertive and intimidating, he was a quick study, adjusting to new realities, negotiating when the situation called for it, and persuading others by means of coercion, intrigue, and charm. Seemingly distant but seductive, in his advanced age he was resolute, confident, and mostly uncompromising. Discreet, emotionally detached, and ruthless when need be, he mesmerized his audiences and won them over with seeming effortlessness. Added to these complexities were his stern appearance in clerical garb and his imposing comportment. Wearing a black turban and a white beard, in his late 70s he was unapologetically distinct from conventional images of 20th-century revolutionary leaders, ranging from Lenin, Trotsky, and Stalin to Mao, Castro, and Che Guevara. To most Iranian people, who for decades had not seen a turbaned man in a position of power, Khomeini appeared unique, often unsmiling, his piercing eyes underneath frowning eyebrows, his monotonous but solemn voice, which betrayed a central Persian countryside accent with an Arabicized Malar intonation, spawned an image of an ascetic from bygone times. To many of his countrymen, such unconventionality was awe-inspiring, even terrifying, and yet appealing. His austerity, fearless and fierce, stood in stark contrast to the formalistic militarism of the Pahlavi era, and especially to the Shah's royal opulence. In his plain cloak, he appeared deceivingly authentic in contrast to the Shah's dazzling appearance in military uniform, rich with fringes and accoutrements. The Ayatollah's coterie was smart enough to capitalize on this image, and Khomeini cleverly allowed them to do so. No one seemed to have been able to resist the rising star of the new political prophet, not the self-deceiving liberal nationalists, the rationalizing intellectuals, the radicalized left and guerrillas with Kalashnikovs, the intimidated pro-Pahlavi middle class, the Shah's army and Savak, or even the Islamically correct freedom movement. Listening to the mood in the Iranian streets and cleverly negotiating the unique window of opportunity opened before him, Khomeini stressed national unity and Islamic solidarity against the corrupt and repressive Pahlavi idol and the idol-worshipping institution of kingship itself. References to an alternative political order, an Islamic republic, soon made their entry into his many statements and public addresses. In a matter of months, in mid-1978, explicit demands for an Islamic republic became an integral part of the street slogans and revolutionary rallies. Sovereignty, freedom, the Islamic Republic. Esteklal, Azadi, Jomhuriye Islami. As if a utopia were being ushered in before their eager eyes, the marching crowds echoed the rhymed slogans that called on the Imam, the Saviour, to lift tyranny and lead them to a promised land. The Shi'i messianic motifs behind Khomeini's image as Imam of the community, Imam-e-Amat, were unmistakable. Motifs that inspired millions to call on him to save the country and the world. Sovereignty, on the other hand, hearkening back to memories of the post-war national movement for control of Iran's oil resources, found in the revolutionary imagination a new lease on life a quarter of a century later. Revolutionaries began to see the United States, rather than Britain, as the prime culprit responsible for Iran's economic dependency and presumed subservience. The concept of freedom, Azadi, too, gained prominence among its proponents, who were mindful of half a century of Pahlavi autocracy. They demanded an open political space and aspired to a just and tolerant society. Khomeini and his cohorts were riding on the back of these ideals, all the while pushing the project of the Islamic Republic and thrusting it forth into the still amorphous revolutionary sphere. The nature of the Islamic government was ambiguous, at least to the majority who called for it, and perhaps even to its chief advocates. How spontaneous Khomeini's Islamic message was remains a matter of debate. There is little doubt that his idea of a revolution with Islam as its defining principle substantially changed along the way from Najaf to Paris to Tehran. Even more than other classic revolutions, the dynamics of the popular movement in Iran had not been set at the outset by any one individual or ideological trend. It was more the outcome of a turbulent push and pull. To a great extent, Khomeini's talent for adjusting to different situations, incorporating multiple concepts, adopting various strategies, and utilizing various political tools, allowed him to glean current ideas and vocabularies from diverse quarters: the radical left, dissident intellectuals, Islamic radicals, the media, and even army jargon, so as to tinker his own ideology. It is possible to speculate, on the basis of Khomeini's statements and conduct, that in early 1977 he had hoped for the political space to open up and Iran's constitutional order to be redeemed. At the time, he probably was satisfied with Ghosn's greater say in the affairs of the country and greater respect for conservative Islamic values. Encouraged by the rapid course of events, he later that year may have started envisioning the departure of the Shah and investiture of an emasculated constitutional monarch, though he hardly could have hoped for or predicted the collapse of the Pahlavi order. By the beginning of 1978, however, he began to contemplate a greater role for himself as the prime mover behind a revolution mandated by the Iranian people and governed by Islamic principles. By then, the senior clergy, too, almost unanimously had joined the revolutionary fold and were, willy-nilly, rallying behind him. Earlier on, Khomeini preferred to speak of a movement, Nahzat, rather than a revolution, Engelab, the latter being a modern notion still alien to his conservative tastes. He had his moments of hesitation, no doubt, but was adamant about his immediate objectives. He must go, Boyad Berovad, was his call for the Shah to abdicate, which he relentlessly demanded despite the many cautionary messages from his own advisers. To this end, he called for solidarity, Vahdat, among all popular forces. All together, Hamah Baham, became his catchphrase, calling for a united front that ranged from the liberal nationalists to Islamic reformists, diverse clerical tendencies, disgruntled intelligentsia, secular or Islamist intellectuals, the Mujahideen-e-Khalq, and even various shades of Marxist. To such a diverse assortment, he was careful to convey a tantalizingly simple message of unity that ordinary people could easily grasp. After years of silence, the thrill of enormous multitudes, hundreds of thousands, if not millions, crying out, neither Eastern nor Western, but the Islamic Republic, Nashargi, Nagarbi, Jamhuriya Islami, was intoxicating, even if the true ramifications of an Islamic Republic were not yet understood even by Khomeini's close allies. That Khomeini became the Imam of the Islamic Revolution and its guardian, Vali, was particularly remarkable, given the connotations of both terms in the Shi'i messianic context. In the long history of Shi'ism, no other mujtahid or any other mainstream figure had ever assumed the title of Imam or was referred to as such by his following. Imam in 12-er Shi'ism was exclusively reserved for the 12 Imams, whom the Shi'is considered loci of divine inspiration and true successors to the Prophet of Islam. In effect, Khomeini no longer was a mere jurist or a marja. He appropriated qualities of a deputy of the Shi'i Mahdi. He theoretically was assumed to be a deputy of the Imam, Na'ebe Imam. Yet he was routinely addressed as Imam in everyday parlance, and that was what mattered in a revolutionary environment. Even claim to individual deputyship on behalf of the Imam of the age, as opposed to the collective authority of the mujtahids, was pure novelty. No established authority since the 9th century had ever claimed to be the deputy of the Imam. Even Abdul Ali al-Karaki's claims in the 16th century were couched in a cautious legal language that limited the implications of jurists' deputyship. Ironically, any such claims by messianic prophets stood to be denounced by the mujtahids and gravely punished, as in the case of 19th century Sayyid Ali Muhammad the Bab. Likewise, the term Vali and Valayat, with historical reference to Ali ibn Abi Talib, the fourth caliph and the first Shi'i imam, connoted a politico-moral authority for the guardian jurist and a true vicarage of that community. The mystical undertone associated with the idea of Valayat in Sufism, particularly Shi'i Sufism, injected an element of the sacred to the otherwise worldly office. In effect, it may be argued, the revolution finally brought the messianic process within Shi'ism to a head. The Mahdi paradigm was employed not by a charismatic prince warrior like Ismail I, the founder of the Safavid Shi'i state. Nor did an antinomian Noctavi Kalandar claim it, or Sayyid Ali Muhammad Shirazi, the Bab. Rather, here, a representative of the jurist orthodox establishment, a mujtahid and a marja, crossed the long-protected boundaries of normative and messianic Shi'ism to appropriate the mantle of the Prophet and become the saviour of an Islamic revolution.